AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 145 for April 13th, Mao, more than ever. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Hey, thanks for joining us again here, folks, for AutoLine After Hours, and especially good to be back in the studio with you, Peter.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
You survived Katz is okay.
Survived the New York Auto Show. It was a whale of a show.
Yeah, it was a great show.
It was, and everybody's saying that. Wow, you know, the best New York Auto Show.
Since 1961.
And that's Jim Hall, ladies and gentlemen. That's Jim Hall piping up. Yes.
And yet, there was something missing at the show. But we'll get into that.
Oh, we will. Okay. Good. I want to hear about that.
Me too.
So have you been driving anything fun lately, Peter?
Still driving a Panamera.
Well, that I know. Yeah, that's a fun one.
Still liking it.
I know. Yeah. Who would not like that car? That's for damn sure. I've been driving a 6 Series convertible BMW.
How's that?
You know, I'm not. It's a beautiful car. It's a very expensive automobile. Well, north of 100 grand. But, you know, it just doesn't rock me. It's kind of heavy and ponderous. And
looks great as a four-door coupe.
As a four-door coupe.
There is the Grand Coupe. It's being released for the States. It's 6 cylinders only. Hmm. But it really, it's one of those things that's like, yeah, that looks pretty okay. It works. It's weird. It works as a four-door coupe. It's longer wheelbase than your car.
You know, I think if I was tooling down Rodeo Drive or if I was in Boca with the top down, and that's another thing. You know, we've had a spate of cold weather here, so I haven't had the top down, so that... I mean, that's what a convertible's all about.
Not here.
Right?
We've had sunny weather.
I know it's been sunny, but it's not been convertible weather. Not for me, at least. So that's what I've been in the last week. And like I said, it's a beautiful car, but it's not what I would aspire to. So in the news, F1 IPO. They're talking about $2 billion this venture capital firm that owns part of it, because it seems like everybody's got their fingers in the pie when it comes to F1. But is this thing going to, $2 billion IPO, is this going to happen?
Well, I'm kind of shocked at how cheap it is.
I agree.
I mean, I heard one figure was more like, the real number was more like $13 billion. But even then...
Well, remember, this $2 billion is 20% of all the stock.
Correct.
So theoretically, if... 20% is worth $2 billion, then 100% is worth at least 10.
Yeah.
So.
But that's not even a blip on the radar of an NFL team.
Well, I looked that up because that's a really good question. And the average NFL team is valued at about $1 billion. So there's 32 NFL teams.
You get the whole team there.
The NFL in its totality is valued at $32 billion. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Peter, yeah, that's surprising because... Mm-hmm. F1 being global and whatnot, and
but it's getting you a relatively small percentage of it, and you know that's the other issue. It's not like getting 50% of something where you might be able to exert some kind of influence, but you got, let's say you got 10%.
And I don't think it's going to go. I mean, I don't think it's going to do what they're hoping it's going to do. Why would you want 20% for $2 billion?
Well, here's the other question: is how's F1 going to grow its revenues? Okay, it's big, it's wealthy, but it's not like they're adding all kinds of races to the schedule. As well, they cut them.
But they have, you know, got more races this year than ever. It's 20 races this year. But that's probably at the limit of the capacity of the teams to participate.
Right. Otherwise, their heads will explode.
Well, exactly. Or you end up, because, you know, the absurdity of Formula One in some ways is that everything you do to try to make Formula One.
Get your mic back on.
I meant to do that.
The absurdity in Formula One is the way they try to do these things to make Formula One more affordable. Now, the thing that gets me is this is an expensive race. So one of the things they do to make it affordable, you can no longer have backup cars. So the teams bring a primary structure, chassis parts, so they have to assemble one at the track. Why is that any cheaper?
you know, it's absurd.
It is a circus, and it's Bernie's personal playground. He's become the second richest person in England because of it.
Well, I wonder about the U.S. Grand Prix that's going to be in Austin, too. Okay, I think they'll pull it off by the end of this year, but how long is it going to last? Because how many U.S. Grand Prix have there been? You know, Watkins Glen, Detroit, L.A.,
Long Beach,
Phoenix.
Riverside.
Well, in 2013, there are going to be two U.S.
Grand
Prix.
Yeah, right.
And I actually think the East Coast one is going to be the one that has the staying power. I mean, Austin is going to be a beautiful track, but how are they going to sustain that track?
I don't know. There's not enough of an audience right there to go to it.
I mean, they're talking about bringing MotoGP over, but, you know, that you need big races there, a lot of them.
Right.
You know,
how long until they do a NASCAR road race there? I mean, it's a necessity, Peter, and they got NASCAR road races, as bizarre as they are.
Yeah, well, they're still...
I don't think they're bizarre. I think they're the best races.
They're the best races in NASCAR, and NASCAR is going to add a road race into the chase. It will be a new road race. The painful thing I read, I think, is where the Frances were building a road course inside Kansas Speedway because they own that.
Yeah.
And they also own the casino there. It's just a cluster of amazing proportion.
Yeah.
Instead of running...
finding a good track. And
running in September during the chase at Elkhart Lake.
That's where it should be.
Yeah,
yes, absolutely.
And that would be an awesome race.
Oh,
that would
NASCAR
be,
cars that rode.
No, there'd be 100,000 people there, and it would be huge, huge. It'd be, but there's no vision in NASCAR. I'm sorry, they keep telling me, oh, we got lots of vision. Yeah, what is it? The manufacturers force you to change the Sprint Cup cars because the car tomorrow didn't work. That vision didn't come from Daytona Beach. It came from Detroit. It came from Ford and General Motors. You know, I keep waiting for the vision.
Yeah. But
I'll say this, when they had a race finished with a guy in third place at Daytona on his roof upside down, sparking on fire, that was NASCAR. I mean,
well, that's America.
That is America, and I'll tell you.
That's different.
What about a requirement that at least one of the cars in the top three has to finish on his roof? I mean, one thing it would do away with this
green, white checker?
Yeah, exactly.
No, they'd still have a green, white checker.
Just but one of the cars would be on its roof. That'd be better.
You just have to have little Joey Chitwood ramps that pop up around the track every now and then.
And we need the spirit of Joey Chitwood in every driving. So you'd like do a J-turn in the parking lot to pull in your spot and get out and go, hiya!
But going back to the IPO, why would you invest in this? What's the vision of how Formula One is going to grow its revenues? I really don't see
They're totally dependent on the manufacturers.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah, but you know what that means? That means they're dependent really on three manufacturers. That's it. Now, Formula One, I love Formula One racing. I love the absurdity of trying to manage it from a cost standpoint. I love the show and the fact that so much is done on Saturday. They have these strange regulations, no fuel anymore, but mandatory stops for tires that really aren't that good. You know, if any other thing said you have to use bad tires for one stint, you go like, excuse me, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. Well, it's all contrived now for the show, and I'm like you. I love Formula One racing. I follow it. You know, and half the fun has always been bitching about how they run the whole circus. But nonetheless, now it's getting contrived where, oh, yeah, you have to have two different sets of tires, and you have to use each one. And, yes, you've got this movable wing, but you only can use it right here in this track, and only if you're within a second of, you know, it's like this is...
I got to tell you, the racing throughout the field at Barber for the IndyCars was outstanding.
I totally agree.
It was outstanding. There were guys, like, racing for 13th position, like...
It was good racing.
Yeah, all the way through the pack.
But, you know, I still wish it wasn't a spec series. Now, we're getting a little bit better in terms of the engines. But Lotus isn't there, but...
They just announced that there's a rule. If you change engines before 1,850 miles in IndyCar, you're dropped 10 positions. In testing... earlier this week, I think it's Sonoma, one of the Chevy engines blew. They took it apart and decided that they had to change all the Chevy engines.
Otherwise, they would have blowed in the race.
So at Long Beach, no matter where the Chevys qualify,
they'll be at least 11th place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, look, you know, the racing is that good, and as you know, at least at the start of the race, It's not a help, but a lot of the good drivers will make that difference up.
Yeah, but Long Beach is tough.
Long Beach is probably the most brutal track they have.
It's very difficult to pass there. And
it's easy to crash now in that first left-hander after the straight, the start-finish straight. It's gotten just diabolically bad in the first lap. And then diabolically bad on restarts. When you're watching, it's like, didn't that guy just do that? And then the kind of racing that had the promise of being the relevant racing for a while was WRC, mm-hmm. which has become totally irrelevant as nobody plays in it. I mean, there's a time where WRC, you know, they were doing regular television.
Well, there's Ford and Citroën.
Yep.
Two main teams, right?
Yep. And there was a time you had multiple teams in it. And I'm talking after the Killer Bees, because the Killer Bees were amazing automobiles. But, Lordy, nobody thought you've got Formula One technology in a car that's racing 7 inches from trees. This is not a good idea, guys.
But it's some of the coolest racing going on because they look like street cars.
They look like street cars, and the guys that are driving them to me are the absolute masters of car control.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see something like the Swedish Rally, where they're racing on tires that are probably about this wide, on cars with flares for tires 7-8 times wider, and the cars are just dancing around, it's impressive. But because it's not really supported by manufacturers anymore, it's like, yeah. So,
well, you know, it never caught on in this country because it was really not covered well in television.
And it's a difficult spectator sport.
Yeah.
Okay, plain and simply. Right. For the spectator, it's difficult.
The only way it would work in the U.S. is if they ran around the trees and then drove on freeways at a controlled space and ended up in a stadium so that they could do the last stage. Otherwise, Americans just, you know, we're not going to drive out in the woods. Sorry,
no.
we don't do it.
Racing brought to us, sort of.
You know, we'll go to big road race tracks like Road Atlanta, Road
America. But
then
the spectacle's being brought to you there because it's the whole thing, the whole enchilada.
But, you know, it's just tough.
But, you know, no racing really is as good as watching it on television anyways. And, you know, I learned that years ago back in the Champ Car thing where Ford invited me out to Laguna, Mazda Speedway. And
it's still annoying.
The whole team, in the pits, they're watching TV. And I'm thinking, what the hell did I come out here for if the teams themselves are watching TV?
Formula One races at some tracks are worth it just because of the sensory input.
Well, racing is still better
in
person.
Yeah. Right.
Racing is still better in person.
But if you want to follow what's really going on in the race,
you need a tube.
You need, well, the best is having a television right at the track.
The headsets drive you crazy. Yeah. I won't do that. That's just ridiculous. But for one thing, people who only watch NASCAR on TV have no idea how fast they really are in person on those super speedways or on a track like Atlanta, where they're going 200 miles an hour, and it's just like an eye-opener.
It is. I totally agree. But if I want
and
to
Indy.
Know... And Indy, too. No, I totally agree. But I like to analyze the races. I like to anticipate what's going to happen. You know,
and
it might
be... You can't...
This guy in fifth place really has got more fuel. The others have got... You know, you don't know that stuff unless you're watching.
Well, Indy... The good thing about Indy is, well, if you're fortunate... I mean, you can do the headsets, but... If you're part of a suite, you can go up and watch it on the roof and stay out there, then go back in the suite and get an update of the positions and, you know, but...
That's not many people can do that. We're lucky enough to do it.
Yeah, Indy is great, though, in person.
Uh-huh.
I tell everyone, if someone tells me that they've never been in Indy, I said, you owe it to yourself to go once. The start is the most electric moment in all of sport.
I'll tell you
just motorsport, sport.
I'll tell you another amazing track is Michigan Speedway when they ran the
Twin 125s.
Well, I was thinking of when they were running the really fast, obscenely fast kart cars, remember?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just the speed there when you were watching, and you could not imagine a car was able to move that quickly and still turn and steer. It was like...
Two best oval races ever, in my opinion, was the year that Rick Mears and Michael Andretti dueled at the end of the Indy 500, where Michael went around Rick going into one on the outside to make the pass. On the outside, and the very next lap, Rick did the same move on him and then went on to win. The other one was at MIS when Juan Pablo Montoya and Michael Andretti dueled over the last 10 laps. Still the most exciting oval race I've ever seen. That was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And it's funny because those are both tracks that are very friendly spectator tracks.
Yeah, you can see everything, and they're pretty much driver-friendly, especially.
Well, Indy, Indy's, you can't really see everything.
You can't. It's just too big. That back straight, if you're in some of the stands, is totally invisible.
Right.
And conversely, if you're in one of the boxes over on turn two, there's a big chunk. You don't see four, which is the saddest part. Because, you know, four is where a lot of stuff happens in Indy. Right.
Well, the MIS, you can see a lot.
You can.
And it's a very wide track, so it allows the drivers to take all kinds of different lines, which is great for racing. Mm-hmm. Hey, another thing I wanted to ask you guys about, Ferdinand Porsche passing away.
Yeah.
The grandson, not...
That's right. It's not Dr. Porsche.
Right.
Who loved to drive American cars, by the way.
Did he really?
Ferry Porsche's son.
Yep.
Who designed my all-time favorite car, the Porsche 911.
The Ferdinand Porsche, who just died, designed the 911.
Yeah.
Nickname?
Bootsy.
Bootsy.
How'd you get a name like
that? Ferry Porsche's son.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yep. And if you think about it, the 911 is an interesting car because the story Porsche's had when they introduced the 991, the new 911, is impressive when they walk through it and they show the evolution of the car and why it did exactly what it did. And it's very sensible. But what's interesting is they've made a sensible story out of a car that anyone in their right mind would not design today. You would not design a car with the engine behind the rear axle. And they went ahead and did it. But the fact that they were able to use the DNA from a car that was first shown in 1963. The 901 was at the 63 Frankfurt Motor Show.
But it really came out of the 356.
Right. Well, it did and it didn't. When you look at the cars, you see the idea behind it. But it was not trying to reinterpret a 356. It was trying to do a new car with the constraint that they had.
Correct.
And it really was a new car. And
it was, but I'm just saying, rear engine, air-cooled, boxer, blah, 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 swing axles, the whole nine yards, right.
And the funny thing is, when the 901 came out, and there were all the Porsche fanatics then who were only into 356s and would tell you that the Cs were no good because they had those damn disc brakes. They're awful. But every new Porsche is hated by the current Porsche owner. it's wonderful. And it was that way when they did the 911, then when they did the G cars, the bumper cars. Then they did them again with the 964, which was the worst 911. It was awful. The car was just awful. And then the 996, which a lot of people say, well, that was the beginning of the end because it had water cooling for the heads. But the point is, that was recapturing a lot of what the original 911 was in a car. And then they did the 996, which is a car that I understand why they did it, because if they didn't do it, they wouldn't have been able to survive.
Yeah.
But they fixed it rather quickly, because the 997 took it and sort of said, yeah, okay, sorry. And the new car, have you driven it yet?
No.
The new car is absolutely, unequivocally spectacular and wonderful. And people that don't like Porsches will like that car. And people that like Porsches, the only thing is, it's like, it has electric power steering. Drive the car.
Yeah, no, I've said that on the website.
Yep.
People say, I say, drive the car, please.
And it's astonishing. And the thing is, that's a car where they have deliberately use the cues that Bootsy Porsche did for his first car in it. That's where you can see that it is about keeping the I'm probably using the wrong word here, and there's somebody that could fix this for us in verbiage, but they're taking the visual DNA and saying, we are this car still. Down to the point that the car's gone through changes. You know, it ain't a 911. The new car's a 991. The one before it was a 997, but they never had a badge on the back that said 997. The new car doesn't say 991, although theoretically it could make the badge.
Well, you can order it with
911.
Just 911.
Yeah.
Which is how I will order mine, maybe. If
hey,
I can.
I want to talk more about design, especially about your column, but we also have David Rand joining us tonight, who is a designer, and we ought to bring him in on this discussion. So why don't we do that? But first, we have to thank one of our sponsors. So, Ben, why don't we thank our friends at Bridgestone? So, David Rand, thanks for joining us here for AutoLine After Hours.
Pleasure to be here.
So, you're an automotive designer, but give us a quick thumbnail background for those who don't know you.
Okay. Most of my career was at General Motors. The last job I had there, I was executive director of Global Advanced Design. Before that, I was executive director of North American Interiors, and I did a stint in Brazil. And just recently, I have worked for Chang'an Automotive in China, and I have just recently come back from China.
Well, that's got to be fascinating. We got to get into that, too. But, Peter, you wrote your column this week on the importance of design, but not just any design.
No, it's something struck me at the show. I mean, I like the new Impala. John Cafaro did the car, his team, and I thought he did a great job on it. And, you know, but after I saw this, the succession of introductions, I realized that, you know, how did we get to this point where these are all new designs, yet they're all very similar, you know? I mean, the detailing's different, but it's just all very similar. And to the point where they're boring because they're expected. And I don't know what it is. The design community, you would know this better, but there seems to be faddism going on where someone comes up with something and then they race back and do their version of it. Whereas, you know, I'm not saying everything was all great in the 60s, but seemingly in GM's heyday, there was much more risk-taking going on.
But you had a bunch of people copying the GM stuff.
Exactly.
Ford and Chrysler.
Well, up to a point, but then they went their own way. I mean, Chrysler went their own way. Ford went their own way, too. But, I mean, and Ford led with the Mustang and caught GM with their pants down. But there's a sameness going on in the business right now that I think is unfortunate. There's no real excitement like, wow, you know, they're all great. And the cars today are fabulous. They run great. They're beautiful, beautifully made, you know, in terms of modern.
But not unique, iconic design. Bang, the world just changed.
Yeah, not unique, iconic design. I mean, think about the 60s when the E-Type came out, followed by the Stingray. I mean, you know, of course, I'm biased. The Stingray, the original Stingray is my all-time favorite car.
Do you buy this argument, David?
I think there may be, within every generation, if you ask this question, you get the same answer. You know, cars continually look alike. If you ask people in the 50s, did cars look alike? The 60s, they may give you the same answer. Because the cars you talk about in the 60s were really the exceptions. You know, most of the stuff, if you think even at General Motors, which, when I was growing up, was the high point. You know, Buicks and Oldsmobiles, there was some distinction, but there was still a general feeling of how design went. And, of course, at that point, you know, Ford and Chrysler were copying General Motors. So the American car had a certain sameness even in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I guess today, what would be an opportunity to do something drop-dead different and, you know, jaw-dropping like the E-Type and the Stingray?
But those are easy to do.
Sports cars are the easiest cars to do.
To me, right. I'd like...
Sedans are the hardest.
Yeah, but I'd like to see a new Riviera. Mm-hmm. A Buick Riviera that was just jaw-droppingly, OMG, that is just stunningly beautiful. That's right. What I would like to see at an auto show. And, you know, yeah, you can do the sedans. The Impala's nice. It's competent.
Peter, that's the thing. Those cars have to be special kinds of cars. They can't be everyday run-of-the-mill kinds of cars.
Well, yeah, I know. I know the mainstream cars tend to blend together, but... it's a general desire for this, you know, the sameness. We need a spike. We need something. Now, I thought and I mentioned in my column, I thought the CL was stunning. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the hardtop version of it only in a sketch, very nice sketch, and it is going to be stunning. And I think currently, and I mentioned that in the column, I think the current CTS coupe is a stunning car.
Yeah, it's one of those cars.
One of those cars where you see it on the road, and it's been out a while, and I never get tired of looking at it.
Yeah.
Ever.
Well, from the perspective of an enthusiast or a designer, I mean, we'd all like cars to have more personality and be more distinctive. But I'm wondering, if you talk to the average car buyer, do they have the same desire? And
well, it's a different world now.
Of course.
But it's a matter of degree, too, because Hyundai, who I was visiting with today, thinks that one of the key of their current successes is that their styling is more expressive.
Absolutely.
And now, you know, look at what Toyota's doing with their latest cars, like the Avalon or Chevy, really, with the Impala.
The Avalon, to me, is a bigger breakaway from where they've been than the Impala is for Chevy.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. It's a radical breakaway, whether you like it or not. And the thing is, but even it's channeling another car. You look at that car, and it's channeling Audi A7.
Or I think the grill came right off the hybrid version of the Sonata.
And Toyota showed one car at the Detroit show that I thought was stunning, their concept, the NS4.
Sure.
which I thought was a yep. gorgeous car. I mentioned in my column, I thought that to me was indicating that, you know, Toyota, well, there are talented designers all over the world.
Well, and typically, though, design staffs are creative. It's management that keeps them bottled up, right?
Production cars reflect more the attitude of the management of the companies than the design talent of the car companies.
Well, you know, obviously, if you talk to the average designer, they were going to do something much more expressive and much more adventuresome than they're generally allowed to do. But you mentioned the Avalon, and it is more of an adventuresome car than Toyota generally does. But at the same time, when you first see the photographs, you don't know what it is because it is so different from what Toyota is doing. So, on one hand, it's good, they're progressing, but on the other hand, you know, it kind of underscores the fact that Toyota doesn't have a very strong family DNA.
Not at all. Not from a design standpoint. But that's why I like what I see in the Avalon, and they needed a break. So I think this is one of those examples where it's okay not to have DNA, but I'm not a designer.
But John, they have to do what Hyundai did, because think about it. The Sonata was a breakout car. It came out, and there was no context for anything else than Hyundai had done. But they sort of took it and evolved it for the Elantra. So that's what you need. But the point is, that's what you're doing. When you do these cars, you have to use them to feed your brand, so you've got a brand theme.
Well, and hopefully there was a strategy when they did this. In other words, they didn't just, you know, fall on the Sonata and say, okay, this is pretty good. Let's copy it again and again.
Yeah.
Hopefully at the beginning, there was a strategy that stated, we're going to start with this and then build on this going forward with other cars.
But the thing is, if Toyota doesn't do that with the Avalon, if they don't proliferate that design DNA, then they had an opportunity that's been totally missed, and they could do another car that could be just as radical for what it is, but have no context. So it's like it's another car that just doesn't fit in with what we think a Toyota is. And they don't do products that sort of establish what a Toyota is visually.
Well, it also tends to say that if they go into another design direction after the Avalon and says, well, we're really not serious about this design direction, and that says something about the design department in Toyota as a whole.
And the management that selects the cars.
Absolutely.
I'm just very encouraged to see them make this break because they've recognized that this aura of invincibility that they had with quality.
It's currency they can't trade on like they used
can't.
To.
And their advantage, former advantage.
That's the price of admission. I mean, if you don't have quality, you...
Right, but for so long, Toyota was able to do so well.
That was their DNA.
That and fuel efficiency.
Yeah.
They were just perceived as having better fuel economy, whether true or not. And they know them days is gone. And I give Akio Toyota a lot of credit because I think he's the guy who said, hey, guys.
Personally, I think he gets all the credit because the company inertia would have kept it going the way it was. It would have.
But let's be honest. This isn't the first time Toyota has said that we're going to get more serious about design. They've said that years ago.
Yeah, but their serious before was they put the little pig nose on everything. There was. They let's make the badge bigger and move it up the hood. So with the hoods, that's all there was. Right. That was their design DNA. So what they had was hood DNA.
That's why the NS4 was, to me, in Detroit, was so impressive. And that's why the Camry and the Avalon were unimpressive.
Well, the Camry, totally unimpressive to me. I think the Avalon's actually pretty decent.
Well, yeah, but it's not like the NS4.
No,
the NS4,
no.
I'm hoping that's their future direction. And the Avalon, they just kind of tweaked the last minute. I mean, let's face it, I've beat it to death, but design is the ultimate initial product differentiator.
Sure. Absolutely.
And it will be even more important going forward. And the best example we have is Hyundai. What did Hyundai lack? Quality and reliability. Number one, they fixed that. What was the second thing they liked? Design. They went out and hired some talented designers. What are they working on now? Vehicle dynamics. They're not there yet.
Yeah, they have a ways to go.
Yeah, but the design component is really accelerated.
Yes, very.
And, design will, I mean, if we have this democratization of technology, so you have these $25,000 cars jam-packed with technology that 5 years ago you'd never see, unless it was an exotic, then design is really going to become more crucial.
The other thing about design, when you do it right, it's a marketing function, in that makes a statement every time a customer sees the car that they don't get if you have a nicely styled car. It's like, okay, yeah.
Go look at Audi. I mean, when people see Audis, I mean, Audi is... took them 12 years, but they've transformed their reputation, their image on the street. It's all about street image. Bill Mitchell had the most fabulous gut for street image, I think, in history, maybe besides Harley Earl.
Well, I keep making the point, too, that he reported directly to the chairman. And man, I think there's no way better than to get attention to what you're doing and have everybody go, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, as to when you report to the chairman.
To a chairman of a company, and the chairman understood the business he was dealing with, unlike subsequent chairman of General Motors.
Absolutely right.
You know, the thing that the failure of General Motors is that the people who should have kept the company out of trouble were the people that put the company into the position it went into.
And, you
financial.
Know, speaking of Hyundai and its quality, one of the ways that they fixed quality at Hyundai is the guy who was put in charge of getting it straightened out reported directly to the chairman.
Yep.
Didn't come up through the engineering ranks or PD or whatever. No, it went right to the chairman.
Which in a Confucian company is a problem. Because the Confucian philosophy is all through Hyundai, the parent company. And it's one of the problems. You don't... Confucian philosophy, one of the basis is you respect your father, and by doing that, you will respect everyone. You will gain respect. And the other part of it is that because of that aspect of it, if you're disrespectful to the chairman, you're disrespectful to the company and all the people that work for it. So getting anybody that pushes the organization in a company like Hyundai to do it, unless he can get straight to the chairman, it'll get filtered out and he'll get parked.
Yeah, and
getting parked in Hyundai is a problem because there's a lot of them.
This is, I think, one of the problems that the Chinese will have going forward.
What way? What do you mean?
Well, the reporting structure, at least, you know, from what I experienced and what I have been told by journalists and other designers is... The companies tend to be very inward focused. They do clinics, they do some research, but you're basically trying to please the chairman. And if the chairman thinks that he's the design director and the engineering director, and that before he moves on to his next job, the companies won't be competitive. You know, for a long time, I think people assumed that, you know, China would go the way of the Koreans, that, you know, in another 10 years, it would be fully competitive. I don't believe that anymore.
Really? Oh, fascinating. Why not?
Because part of the structure. I think products tend to be a reflection of the culture and the capability of a company. And given the culture that I think the Chinese companies have...
Copying is okay there.
Copy is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it was actually a heartbreaking experience to see designers that were basically doing Photoshop and not clean sheets of paper. And, you know, trying to say, this is not the way to do it. This is not a good thing. And having to explain that.
But they've got to recognize that. I mean, there's got to be people in China who are recognizing that, you know, we just can't. If we, and as you know, brand building, they recognize as one of their weak points. And yes. You're not going to build great brands by Photoshopping other people's designs.
But it's a very strange situation because on one hand, China has every brand, automotive and others, competing in that country. It's the place to be right now. At the same time, there is the domestic industry that is actually not so well respected.
It's brand poor functionally, isn't it?
Not at all, right.
And it's not just because of the brand. It's because of the actual quality of the cars, and the consumers know about that. So to have a Chinese car is, if you're getting to the market and you're trying to just do it on the lowest price possible, you buy a Chinese car. But as soon as you're capable of affording something else, you move to a foreign brand.
What do you make of this move by the Chinese to force all the foreign brands to start an all-new Chinese brand?
It's difficult because on one hand, I think the domestic companies don't want to do it, and this is really being dictated by the government. So the problem with establishing a brand or the rightness of establishing a brand is maybe not so much of a choice here.
I was told that the real reason that the Chinese government forced the foreign automakers to start brands and not using existing platforms but to design it from scratch was because even though China has lots of engineers, it doesn't have chief engineers who are capable of designing or developing a car from scratch. And so this is why they forced it, was to grow up a new generation of really good PD and chief engineering talent within the country.
I wish them luck. Because I think it's a very difficult
situation. So you think it's structure of the corporation and culture, too?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's even a branding issue because Geely has decided they're going to add a premium brand. And this is a company that owns Volvo. And it's going to expand Volvo in China and build Volvos in China. Yet they're still going to do a domestic Chinese premium brand. The problem is that the Chinese car buyers are far more cosmopolitan than the government thinks they are. The fact is that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, if you have cars where a company makes, they're Chinese-built Audis and there are still imported Audis. And the perception of buyers is that the German-built Audi is a better car, or the Bratislavan-built Audi, because it's a Q7, yeah, is a better car than the Chinese-built Audi. So when the domestic brands are going to do premium brands, this means they're going to be the healthiest guys of the under-considered brands. And they don't address this issue. Creating artificial brands, the public isn't that stupid. They're really not. These guys know what's happening. They're exposed to automotive information from around the world. They're guys in China that are watching this.
There are two groups of Chinese. One is the cosmopolitan Chinese in the major cities who are as brand conscious and aware as anybody else is on Earth. And then there are the more rural Chinese who are basically buying cars based on the nearest dealership, and again, price here, and may not be as educated as the others. But these two groups still exist. The irony is, given the fact that the Chinese are so brand conscious, they are very aware that the German versions of their German cars are better than the Chinese versions. And I asked one journalist about this, and I said, you know, the rumor is that the Chinese versions are not as good. And he said, yes, that's true. And he was driving a Mercedes C-Class, and I said, if you know this, why are you driving this? And it said, well, you don't understand. It's for my family. There are a lot of dynamics that happen in China that I don't think we're so aware of. But clearly, the prestige brands right now are, as the industry begins to moderate, you know, I think 2011, everybody is aware, was really the first year in 10 years that you weren't getting double-digit increases. Still, the prestige brands are doing wonderfully
just
well.
Just fine, yeah. The luxury segment really hasn't slowed that much.
No, not at all.
They're not impacted by it. So you don't see the Chinese government, or not government, but the Chinese auto industry, excuse me, changing anytime soon then?
Well, I used to believe that at any point in the near future, the Chinese would have gotten all the intellectual property they needed to be, you know, world competitors in the industry. And at that point, they would politely disinvite everybody.
Yeah, say thank you, foreign friends, for helping us. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Right. And I no longer believe that at all.
Wow.
I think it is... one person said that, you know, despite having the expertise or being exposed to the expertise and be able to, you know, buy whatever talent they needed, they would still basically have to go through the learning process that everybody else did.
And the decision-making process that's unique to their system. You know, we talk about Hyundai just being on the, you know, kicking butt and taking names, and they are, but at one level they really aren't. Their growth since they came to the United States market, 1.1%, 5.1%. In how many years? 25 plus?
It took them 25 years to hit 5.5% market share.
And the interesting thing is, in Europe, they get to a point where their consideration has grown in these little steps, and once it hits the step, it flattens out again. And part of that is they are also constrained by the Confucian philosophy in the company. The smartest man in Hyundai is the chairman. The chairman makes the best product planning decisions there are because he's the chairman. Now, common sense tells you that nobody's that good. So they're still making mistakes. The thing is that they've decided to proliferate their range and put money where they hadn't done it before. So they're going to win anyway, just because it's the concept of the Texas sharpshooter. Texas sharpshooter goes up to the side of a barn, gets a gun, and just starts firing away. Then when he's done, he goes and paints the bullseye around the biggest cluster of shots. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing the fact that they're shooting so much, a lot of it's landing. But you think about it. We today, and we know there's one brand that didn't work. The Veracruz didn't work.
Right.
And that not everything is panned out the way they want.
But that's true of every car company.
Of course it is. But the thing is, this is a case where the decisions may not have gone through the normal product planning procedure or even the product development decisions that they would go on through in another non-Hyundai company. Every company does product development and product planning differently. And each one has some strengths and weaknesses. But if you lay over that a culture that doesn't reward progressive thought to move forward and get us more, because that's what General Motors culture for the longest time didn't do.
Right.
GM was a company that innovated for decades. Mm-hmm. There was a time between the two wars where General Motors made a substantial improvement to the product every single model year. And after the war, that stopped. And then GM started making decisions for itself rather than for customers. And by the time you got to the Roger Smith, Jack Smith, and Rick Wagner period, they were so insular, they wouldn't know what the right decisions were.
Well, they didn't grow up on the car side of the business.
Exactly.
Whereas if you go back pre-war, they all did.
And the thing about it, Honda grew up on the product side, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's gone. They have people now that are from the business, and look what's happening to the company. I mean, this is a repeated thing that if you do not keep your focus on product, if you don't, you're going to pay for it. And you may not think you're ever going to pay for it. GM didn't think they were going to ever go bankrupt. Do you think anybody in 1982 saw that? No.
No. So going back to China then, David Dodd, I got to believe there are talented Chinese designers there.
There are. It is, in comparison to the West, a fairly green field because, the Chinese auto industry is really 10 years old. And there are schools that produce designers, but they haven't been around very long. So most of the designers that you have there are fairly green. They're not a lot of experienced designers. That's not to say that there aren't some very talented people there, but it's still a very young field, which is why some of the Chinese were bringing in foreign designers.
Is Chang'an state-owned, or is it a...
It is state-owned, yes.
Okay, do you see any difference between the state-owned and the private?
It's PLA-owned,
PLA, I know.
Which is different yet again.
Different yet again, but if you look at, like, the Cherries and the Geelys, which are independent companies, mm-hmm. Do you see any difference between the government-run ones and the really entrepreneurial-run ones?
Maybe a bit. The fact is, Chang'an had a very large design department. They had, I think, three studios within China. They had one in Japan. They had one in Italy. They believed in design, so they had a lot of designs. And because of the foreign locations, foreign designers as well. It's not to say they didn't believe in design, but ultimately, what the chairman wants, what the company's culture is, determines more of a design direction than the ability of the designers.
Dave, is design at one level an input to building a product, right?
Absolutely.
And if you don't know what to do with the input, you know you have to design the car, but if you don't know what you're doing with the design data, you don't have any data at all.
Well, I think, Wayne Cherry said it well a while ago, that you're only as good as your customer is. And you can hire the best talent you can afford, but if you don't listen to it or you don't incorporate it, it doesn't mean anything, does it?
That's right. Giugiaro designed the Eagle Premier.
That's right.
Let's put it this way. His car was approved. They approved that car, and then they did it.
So yeah, it's funny. It's not on his resume.
No.
Hey, we ought to get to some of the questions from our viewers right now and see what's coming in. Ben, we want to go to rapid fire, but before we do that, we have to thank Chevrolet for being one of the great sponsors of this show.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, this is the part of the show where we go to our audience for questions. We call it rapid fire, and Ben, let's get it going. Okay, David, first question right to you. This is from Ripituck. He says, let us know what Chinese cars you like. Show us some well-designed Chinese cars. Are there any at all?
There are... The fact is that a lot of the Chinese car designs were done by the Italians in the last 5 years. So there are some nice sedans out there that have a little bit they're quite professionally done. They have a little bit of character, or Italian character quirkiness to it. There were some cars actually by SAIC that were very nicely done.
What about the Hongyi? Because you talked to the designer of the Hongyi. The Hongyi is the red flag. It's the state limousine, mm-hmm. And they did a modern version of it.
Do you know what the Hongyi is?
I do, and I've seen pictures of the new version. I think it's kind of cool myself.
I do, too.
It was actually the designer. I was fortunate enough to meet the designer who said that from the beginning he was trying to incorporate some Chinese design cues, and he got some of those cues from furniture.
furniture. To me, it's kind of a retro design.
Weren't the taillights lanterns or something?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But the point is that's an interesting whole take on a car, is to use cultural design elements.
Sure.
But there are a lot of people that look at it and they don't understand the car, but I think it's cool myself.
I suspect that may have been the only car that was done from
a Chinese
perspective, purposely done as a Chinese perspective. Everything else is much more of a Western influence.
Okay, Peter, this is for you. This is from Danny Boy in Cleveland, Ohio. He says, where's the alpha DNA that was supposed to be mainstreamed into the new Viper?
You just better ask Sergio that.
Well, I'm glad that it's truly just Viper design.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it may be vehicle dynamics, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, there was even rumors that it would be built on a Maserati chassis and maybe get a Ferrari engine and all that. No, it's a Viper. It's
a Viper.
I still think the design is a letdown, but that's just me.
Except that they boxed themselves into a corner with that car, I think, because the first Viper made this bold design statement. Whether you liked it or not, it was a show car for the street. And they did the second car that was a far better vehicle. But by comparison, it was a Corvette. It really was. And here they've tried to put a little more, to me, of the original DNA in it. But it's got something going on where it looks like it's bent in the middle. I don't know if in person it looked this way, where they've just diminished the body ahead of the windshield, the base of the windshield, and they've got humpy fenders. And it literally looks like it's bending. I don't get it.
I never got a good look at the car. It was swamped at the New York show. And I'm going to wait till I see it out on the street. That's what I've got to do. Let's see what else we've got here. Dr. Botox has a question for Jim Hall. What are the names of the four Edsel models, and which one was not the subsequent name for a domestic vehicle?
Corsair was not a subsequent name for a domestic vehicle, but it was used by Ford of England for the Ford Corsair. The Ranger was a Ford pickup truck. The Citation was obviously the Chevrolet Citation. And most importantly, the Pacer was too wide. But all of the Edsel model names got recycled. Every single one of them got recycled. You know, and if you think about it, you can say that arguably one and a half were unsuccessful vehicles. The Ranger was successful. I mean, it was. That was a vehicle.
As a pickup.
As a pickup. It was a successful vehicle. And the Citation was, too. I mean, they sold a lot of Citations. Now, selling a lot of cars sometimes is a double-edged sword. The Anti-Destination League, for example, they love Omnis, and now they're moving to something else.
Peter, here's one for you, or at least to start it off with. George from Brooklyn says, if modern cars are boring, why do the buying public even care about interesting car design?
No, I think Dave said it best. A lot of them don't.
They don't. I mean, and George goes on to say, you know, Corolla and Camry are bestsellers.
Yeah,
you know,
no.
There's no more generic car I can think of than a Corolla.
Yeah, as enthusiasts, it's hard for us to understand that mindset. But make no mistake, that's the majority of the mindset out there.
I hope I'm wrong about this, but I have a sense that, when I was 16 or 17, car crazy, and a lot of guys were at that point. I think today, not so much.
It's cell phones.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Cell phones, devices, social media. We've talked about this ad nauseum. I mean, they've got, kids have to be forced to go get their licenses.
Right. Mm-hmm.
For us, going in the car was the event. And then for a younger generation, the car was how you went to the event at the mall or whatever. And now transportation's not even part of the event.
Right. But what I find interesting is I ran into a guy who had bought a new Camry. This was three generation ago Camry. He didn't want to buy what is now the second generation ago Camry because he thought it was too assertive. You know, he didn't want to go around trying to show off to everybody. And I mean, my jaw dropped, but that's the reality out there. Whew. Nonetheless, I think still, if you come out with great-looking design, people will go, oh, my God, that's what I want.
See, but now it's great-looking design with the right connectivity or whatever you want inside the car. And that's why there's a car that's sort of floating around out there that could be one of these cars that's transformative. The 130R production version. Might.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I saw it again in New York.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Is that the white one or the red
one? Red one.
The red one.
Red one.
Red one.
The white one's a car anybody could do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. White one is definitely anybody could do it.
Okay, we got a number of phone calls coming in here. Ben, let's bring in one of the phone calls.
Hi, John. This is Doug from Windsor. I was just listening to you on 950 AM Detroit regarding the new GPSs that the auto companies were going to remove. They were going to use the smartphones in the new Spark car, because the smartphones have GPS, in their cars and their phones. The only problem is if you're Canadian, like myself from Windsor, we have limited access to our databases for the U.S. market, and vice versa, U.S. coming to Canada, they're, unless they pay for the data packages, which are quite expensive, those GPS systems will not work in those cars.
Oh, my God.
So
data roaming fees, they're psychotic.
Car companies haven't thought of, but I know myself, I've tried to use my GPS in the United States, and because my data plan doesn't carry me in there, or the cost is like $5 a minute, it's cost prohibitive for myself. Maybe the manufacturers need to look at this a little bit closer. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because what he's talking about is in the new Chevy Spark, instead of having a $2,000 nav system, you just plug in your smartphone, and it becomes the screen for your smartphone, so you have navigation because you've got GPS and maps on your phone. But I didn't know that about Canada.
Oh, but data roaming in general, even within the states on some with some plans, if you get the wrong carrier and you go some places, your data charges are they're eye-watering. So that's going to be a problem if you end up using it for that. I mean, he's absolutely right. You know what? That's when you get a map, a paper thing.
Yeah.
Not only that, it's recyclable and it's reusable.
Okay. Difficult to use when driving.
Yes. But people used to.
Okay, Ryan wants to know, since Opel is going to Australia and some Latin American countries, for the first time as Opel, the brand, why not bring it to the U.S. to sell small Mini Cooper and Fiat 500 competitors?
Well, for one thing, Opel doesn't make a Fiat 500 or Mini Cooper competitor.
I know, but where he's coming from, why not bring the Opel brand here?
I'm not sure that Opel would resonate so much in the United States. I mean, at one point, they did market Opel in the United States.
Sure, the Manta and the Opel GT, and those were good cars.
That was my first three or four cars for that.
Opels?
Right.
I think one of the things is we're getting Opels in this country. They call them Buicks.
Yes.
We actually are.
Yeah.
You know, the say what you will.
The Regal.
The Regal is the Opel insignia, and the Verano is an Opel Astra notchback that's the Excella in China.
That's right.
And if we get the GTC as a Verano, that's an Opel and looks pretty cool. Under that, if you got to the B cars, because there's an Opel B car as well, but the problem is if you get into that, you're going head-to-head with Sonic as far as product, and you'd be talking about a very expensive product compared to a Sonic. So, see, what's interesting is where they're going to be doing Opel. In Latin America is a brand where they've been selling Opel products before, but branded as Chevys. So they're going to have to slim some of the Chevy line down to make room for the Opel line. So there won't be a net plus. It just may be different consideration for the brand. Same's true in Australia.
Well, we were talking about, you know, how brands register with people. And here's a brand that I think in North America, for the most part, just isn't well known enough that would create a demand.
I think one of the problems is this is desperation on GM's part about Opel. Here's Opel. We can't get out of it what we need to. Let's use the brand, export it, and grow it that way.
Which is what the German unions want, right?
Right.
They don't want to cut production and lay off workers. Right. They want to sell
but
more cars
overseas. Exporting those cars to some of those countries that are price sensitive ain't the right thing either.
You can't make them in euros and sell them in pesos.
Absolutely. And then the other problem that's related to that is if you look at then them moving the product around, then you're not going to be selling. I mean, this is why they were going to try to expand Chevy in Europe. So you're going to take Holden, which has been a monolithic brand in Australia, and you're going to start to piece part of it out. I mean, they're getting the new Malibu down there as a Holden Malibu. So now we're going to start cutting to the pie. This is one that's desperation for Opel because GM doesn't know what to do with Opel, and that's sad.
Agreed. Here's one for you, David. How much will new materials affect car design in the future?
Well, I'd like to think that there's nothing better than a design that can't be done, that couldn't be done before because of either technology or materials. So, you know, if you can make the material an enabler for the design and do something different, that's great. But what new materials are we talking about?
Yeah, what is out there? I mean, I think we're going to see a lot more magnesium going forward and a lot more carbon fiber going forward. You know, Ford and Dow just announced today...
low-cost carbon fiber.
Right. In high-volume vehicles,
right.
Not low-volume sports cars.
But, I'm not sure how low-cost carbon fiber would be used in the form of a car or what difference it would actually make.
Mm-hmm. See, with low-cost carbon fiber, there's a question anyway. The basic material, even if you get the cost out of it, is still not going to get close to steel.
Yeah.
I mean, it really isn't. Now, steel is becoming a more sophisticated material as they're doing high-strength steels, they're alloying steels and so on. So steel's getting more expensive, but there still is a pretty substantial gap there. Now, it'll come down because of what the Dow thing, and actually the company that BMW is working with has got a lot of cost out on carbon fiber. When the E1 comes out, it's going to be some stuff some car companies are going to look at and say, that's ingenious.
And I know for a fact that Chrysler is doing some really interesting stuff with carbon fiber on the Viper. Mm-hmm. And I got to get more into that. Hey, we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. in Albany, New York. And looking at the impressive new Chevy Malibu and the new Impala, I couldn't help but ask myself, does GM need Buick in North America anymore? And do either one of you honestly see GM investing the time and resources to restore Buick back to a premium brand, or should they consider phasing Buick out in North America? Thanks.
Actually, Buick was being considered for phasing out right next to Pontiac. There was one thing that really saved it, though.
China.
Absolutely.
Buick exists for China.
Okay, but to his point, do you really need it in North America?
Well,
in China.
The interesting thing about GM, once the great contraction happened and everyone said, this is it, I still believe GM should be Chevrolet and Cadillac. And, Buick belongs here just for nostalgia reasons, but I'd rather have Pontiac. But, I think GM can get away with being Chevrolet and Cadillac.
The concern I have with Buick is that Buick has a tremendous opportunity that they don't have with Chevy. It's a neutral brand to the youngest buyers out there. They don't know what it is. And if they had the right product, they could use Buick to grab those buyers and have a price position that they could use to cultivate above Chevrolet. But the product ain't there now. It takes a rethink of the product. It needs stuff like a very small, very premium, and I mean, not premium, it takes the micro exotic. It takes a Buick that makes people look at it and it bitch slaps them and says, we aren't what you think we are. Because you got a whole generation, for them, it isn't even their grandparents' cars. And they can't do that with Chevy because Chevy is such a monolithic brand. These guys have an idea of Chevy, whether it's relevant or not, because Chevy builds trucks or whatever. That's the opportunity they have. But that necessitates imaginative marketing and a commitment to long-term marketing that General Motors has not shown it's willing or capable of doing.
Okay, Peter, George from Brooklyn. Other than the Prius and Camaro, what current car design will people remember 50 years from now?
Prius and the Camaro.
There's a combo.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. There's a whole bunch of them that people are going to remember.
You named one for sure.
CTS Coupe.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
David, what do you think? Anything out there now that you think will be a collector's item from a design standpoint 50 years from now?
50 years from now. I keep wondering, what will be from 10 years from now. I think some of the Aston Martins today are really classically beautiful cars.
Yeah.
That I think will be remembered. Some of the exotics, I think the Audi R8 is strong enough to be remembered in 50 years.
Mm-hmm. What about Corvettes?
I'm not sure. I mean, on one hand, today's Corvette is such a good car.
Yeah.
It's such a great car.
But it ain't no 63 Stingray.
It's not.
From a styling standpoint.
And that's my point, because it is a great car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, from a design standpoint, I think it's very well done for what
it is. I agree. But is it a 50-year-now car?
No.
Whereas the 63 still is, and will be 50 years from now, I think.
Next year, that car's 50 years old. Car's 50 years old next year.
The Corvette?
The Stingray.
Oh, the Stingray is.
The 63 Stingray. Yeah. It's 50 years old next year. That's an issue. That tells you something about the nature of that design. If you look back 50 years and say, what were the cars that were that noteworthy? It means that already the E-Type's 50 years old.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So then you say, now, what were those cars in their context? And we're old enough to sort of remember those cars, albeit as kids. But the Stingray was like nothing you'd ever seen. The E-Type was like nothing anybody had ever seen, even though it was an evolution of design philosophy that was all over the D-Type.
See, the question came in as stating that the Camaro will be remembered, and I think the Camaro is one of GM's most handsome designs right now. But all the cars you've mentioned are cars that are standout cars. They were not mainstream cars. And that was part of the reason people remembered them.
Mm-hmm. See, go back 50 years ago, and what were the standout cars 50 years ago? High-volume cars. 1962, what were the standout cars from 1962? Or a car that was in its existence in that. To me, there's one. It's Corvair. It was a standout car. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a car that's remembered fondly by a lot of people.
The first generation, I still think, was a pretty ugly car, whereas the second generation, I still think, looks good today.
Right. But the first generation car set up shockwaves through the entire auto industry.
Right.
It was copied and all over the world. And, I mean, that's a significant design.
There's another American car that we've discussed that I think a lot of people may disagree, but the 61 Lincoln Continental was a standout car at the time.
Absolutely
the
right.
63 Riviera. Mm-hmm. Although I like the ones without the headlights.
The 65.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was the best one, too.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another phone call here. Ben, bring it in.
It's Jonathan out in Old Japan.
All right.
Fantastic seeing you guys last week live and a great show this evening. My question is, will the new Cadillacs, the XTS and the ATS, be competitive in the Chinese market? I understand the CTS was too hard-edged, art and science-like, whereas the XTS and ATS are supposedly designed to be successful in China. My question is, do you believe it will be? Your insights are appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Nice
that's to you, David.
That's a great question. I was a little disappointed when I found out that the CTS wasn't really doing very well in China, and the STS version, the SLS, I believe?
SLS,
yeah.
Didn't do very well either. However, the SRX is being embraced very well, and when I asked why is this, because they're the same design philosophy, I was told that the aggressive Cadillac approach, or at least what's viewed as aggressive in China, was appropriate for an SUV, but not appropriate for a sedan.
So that can make it tougher for the ATS, which is pretty aggressive, the way they've done the lamp graphics and the raised hood and deck lids and so on.
I think certainly the Chinese have probably had some input into the design of those cars, but it still raises the question, will these cars succeed in China? The name is still respected, but the Chinese are sensitive to overly aggressive design on passenger cars.
Is that why the Audi sedans are so popular there?
That's exactly right. And numerous people told me that the Audi for Chinese is a very appropriate design philosophy because it's not terribly aggressive. It's distinctive.
It's graphics over surface.
It isn't overly showy. It doesn't make a big statement, and it's somewhat discreet. And Cadillac, embracing the philosophy that they have currently, is trying to be anything but discreet. So this may pose a problem going forward.
That's a fascinating problem because, China's such an important market. Maybe not for Cadillac yet, but they will sure want to make it an important market for them.
But it's one of the only possibilities for significant growth outside of the United States for Cadillac. They can't do Europe because they have no basis for it. They at least have a dealer base and manufacturing base in China.
But what I'm getting at, does Cadillac have to do styling now that may not work as well in the U.S. because it would work well in China?
We'll see how the numbers go, but if it becomes a dominant part of Cadillac numbers and philosophy, of course it's going to have a philosophy.
Or do they do Chinese market Cadillacs?
Or do
and
they
try
do?
To address the domestic production requirement with that? That's another part of the requirement, in addition to the branding thing you mentioned that the Chinese government wants to do.
But that would pose another problem because the prestige brands don't do regional cars.
Yeah, continuity of design on a global basis, yeah.
That's right. But I think building cars in China will help because not only is there a 25% import tariff, anything imported from the United States gets slapped with another 22% on top of that. Right.
Yeah.
So
I'll be interested to see what happens in the U.S. market with the XTS and the ATS. I think GM, they're going to spend a ton on the ATS. There's something about the design I don't like. I'm sure dynamically it's great, but I think they're going to be shocked. I think the XTS is going to be the Star and Cadillac's lineup in terms of sales and profitability.
I know they'd like that because it's on a unit profit basis.
Right.
It's way better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I think the XCS has much...
XCS is a striking automobile. In the right
it has much better road presence than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And at the New York show, I was talking to Ed Welburn about it because he purposely had a gray one, his favorite color, on the turntable. And I said, yeah, it's going to be a hot car.
Well, Cadillac desperately needs new product. I was... maybe you'd know this, Jim, but last month, Audi outsold Cadillac.
Yes.
Is that the first time that's happened?
Correct.
I think that should be a wake-up call. But, you know, getting two new cars this year will definitely help
and
Cadillac.
And bear in mind, Cadillac also had a shortage of product as well because they'd been tapering off the DTS
Audi
a lot.
Has been closing
right.
the gap
but
month
been doing
by
it,
month.
They've been doing it as they've been dropping their, one of their higher volume, albeit fleet cars, with mm-hmm. no backfill.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's why the XTS is, at a lot of levels, a very important car for them. And it's important for the dealers because they're dealers now that are feeling the pinch. Because for a lot of them, the DTS wasn't a volume car, but it was definitely the cash car for them. And that's why they've got to get XTSs in.
Okay, we've got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Good evening, A-Team. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. One comment to Mr. Lutz and his 40 or 50 push-ups. Brother Semper Fi, what a man, 80 years old. Got a couple other questions I hope you can answer. Is the Delta Wing going to hit any U.S. races? I know it's going to Le Mans, but I just wondered if it's going to catch any races in the United States, like maybe Mid-Ohio or something on that order. And how about that Daytona prototype vet win, first ever? I thought you might want to talk about that later, dudes. Bye.
Thanks, Youngblood.
Well, ironically, the Delta Wing program ends at Le Mans. At least right now. So it's debatable. The ALMS wants it over here, so we'll see. And as far as the Corvette win and DP and Grand Am, that's a body kit. They can call it Corvette all they want. It's a body kit.
Has a Chevy engine.
Has a Chevy engine. Looks kind of like a Corvette, but...
Okay, Crayon Breaking's got a question for you, Peter. What does the NS4 represent? A completely new model or a new direction styling-wise for a current model?
I think it's... I took it as a signal of Toyota's future design direction, period.
It's a design philosophy model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
it's pretty cool.
It is very nice. Very nice.
DC Auto Geek wants to know, can Lincoln create a luxury experience for buyers while still sharing floor space with Fords?
They don't. There are a lot of former Lincoln Mercury dealers that are now Lincoln-only dealers that are bleeding from their eyes and ears because they don't have Mercurys, so it has to work there.
Yeah.
They have got to get the Lincoln retail experience at those Lincoln-dedicated dealers, which I think are like 94% of the dealers they've got out there. They have a lot of standalones, that those guys have got to make it work. They've always had, in smaller markets, the Ford, Lincoln, Mercury dealer franchise. In those cities, it won't change. But where we've got the standalone dealers, they have got to make that dealer experience work. And even if they do that, it may not be enough.
Well, also, like I said on the site, you know, Toyota set the table for customer service with Lexus. I mean, they wrote the book, yep. They raised the bar, all that. Lincoln has signaled that they are going to open a new 5-star restaurant in that space. And that's, you know, that's fine. But ultimately, what does it come down to? The product. If the product is there and the experience just enhances it, fine. It's not the other way around. The experience is cool and the product's not so good, it's not going to work.
Well, I agree with that. But if you remember, you know, Saturn... for years had...
Oh, that was the smoke and mirrors brand.
Absolutely.
It was only the dealer experience.
But it kept the brand going, even though the product was lagging
behind.
Yeah,
you're exactly right. I'm not so sure the Lincoln brand, I think, deserves more.
But the thing is, the Lincoln brand is about baggage, where Saturn wasn't. I think the reason Saturn worked as an experiential brand was nobody knew what a Saturn was, so they sold the experience. With Lincoln, you say Lincoln, and we get 10 people in the room, we're going to have 11 opinions about it, and it's going to be product-centered.
Yeah, well, Hal Reiney created an aura for Saturn that the product didn't deserve. I mean, it was a beautiful, whimsical, you know, springtime in Spring Hill, and people bought it. I mean, there was one study, I remember 70% of the Saturn buyers didn't know that was GM.
And they tried to keep that quiet, too.
Yeah.
So you're right. I mean, yeah, the experience may work, but I think, yeah. See, the Lincoln, the boomers are predisposed. Whoever had fond memories or bad memories of Lincoln, they will at least look. I think it's the younger buyers that Lincoln will have to go after.
And they need to give them a reason to look, and yeah. The product's the easiest way to do it.
Yeah, I think actually it's a great opportunity because there may be some baggage associated with Lincoln now, but I think there's enough people who really don't know what the brand is,
yeah.
So there's enough room to reinvent it.
Yeah, it's an open canvas, but I will say this, and I love the MKZ. It looks good in person. The production car looks good. They need a big rear-wheel drive Lincoln. They absolutely need a big rear-wheel drive line. They need a statement car.
They need a statement car. It doesn't automatically have to be rear-wheel drive. To wit, the Audi A8 works as, but it's got to be the right car. It has to be a right big car.
It's
got
to have a rear-wheel drive proportion.
Right. Yes.
I don't care if it's all-wheel drive.
It has to be a statement. I think the MKZ,
I haven't
seen it in the flesh.
And it makes a big difference,
I'm
Dave. The pictures don't.
I'm reserving an opinion.
Okay.
But it isn't the breakthrough car, the design statement that Lincoln has done in the past.
No, I agree with that, but it is a breakthrough in the sense that for the first time now, Ford is saying, "Look, we're going to spend the money to
differentiate it, so
network.
We will have at
not
least
be fascias.
No, it'll be an identity for Lincoln,
right?
And they're in it for the long term. They understand it's got to be the long.
Well, they're in it for a long term until one of the
before.
Bean counters says,
yeah. "Said this before."
Yeah,
that's true.
When
I
mean, we're part of the Premier Group.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they have shown very little ability to execute long-term strategies when the financial guys say, you know, you're spending a lot of money and we got no incremental sales. And they will start. That's my fear.
Or they get incremental sales and they go, oh, we got this problem licked.
Right.
You're right.
So it's a...
Yeah, you can go dumb
saying,
for either reason.
I keep saying 20 years, $1 billion a year. I believe that's what it's going to take.
Yeah. The Cadillac's in their 12th year. Or 13th year of reinventing Cadillac.
Turnaround, right.
Which it just goes to show how difficult it really is.
Yeah, brand building, especially when you have to hook it to product, is capital intensive for product, capital intensive for marketing, and it is most importantly time intensive. And if you think you're going to do a turnaround in 3 years with this, doing this, you're crazy. If you think it's a decade, you're probably crazy too.
Hey, I think we got another phoner. Am I right there, Ben?
Yes, good afternoon, John. This is Warren from Paris, California, and I'd just like to comment on the design of the new Lexus and the way it's going. I'm sure there's a Hollywood producer that is chuckling because they've copied his 1970s Darth Vader helmet. It looks like it'd be something you can maybe clean a horse stall with or something. As far as Toyota's design goes, to me it seems like they do it on one leg. One foot goes forward and it's a disaster, and the next one is acceptable. They're not consistent at all. And as far as Lexus goes, until this Darth Vader thing, it seemed like they had no style at all. It was just so plain you couldn't tell what it was unless you read the emblem. But thanks for the show. It's good to have everybody together here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Darth Vader. Well, it's not the first time I've heard that comment.
I have heard the Darth Vader comment.
About the spindle grill, the GS spindle grill?
Yeah, new grill.
Yeah. I've heard that.
It's not the first time we've seen this motif on the car, but I think it's a little difficult. But having said that, difficult designs over time, you get a little more used to it, and it is distinctive.
The big grill on the Audis was clumsy to a lot of people at first, too. It really was. It's like... You got to be joking.
Right.
And look how that Audi grill has evolved.
But that's it. That De Silva evolves the look so you know it's an Audi, but they don't set it up so it becomes religion. And I think if they do that with the Lexus grill, that they're not completely literal in how they interpret it. Every car trying to, you got to do this and this. If they do that, they may have more legs with it. I think I'm one of the only people in the room that thinks that it works for what they're trying to do with the car.
I will withhold judgment only because I've only seen these things in auto shows and pictures. I haven't seen one on the street yet.
Right.
And I still say, to my eye, I've got to see it on the street in daylight with other cars around.
Well, we've talked about that. When we go to auto shows and you see them under the lights and then you don't get it. I didn't get the A7.
Oh, until you saw it on the road.
Until I saw it on the road, it came from my left
and, you saw
and, and made a left turn in front of me and drove away, and I just about drove off the road. I said, oh, I get it
And
now.
When you first saw it mostly front with a slip side, and you saw the actual form of the side.
Yeah.
That's a car that when it moves, it all comes together.
But I think with the Lexus, they're hitting you over the head with the front-end graphics, and I think maybe... Given what we've just said about how people perceive automotive design today, you in some ways you have to do that to make a statement. So maybe this conversation would be better held in 3 years' time to see how the public really reacts.
Well, we're going to see the follow-up car fast because they put that graphic on the new RX that was at New York.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. The new RX has it, and that's a car that was sort of heavy with design beforehand, and now they slathered on some more.
Now, having said that, it will be interesting to see how the Chinese received that front end.
Oh, good point, because Lexus is really making a run in China.
Absolutely.
Right now.
And that's aggressive. That's visually
very
aggressive.
Very aggressive front end.
Oh, good tip to keep an eye on there. Hey, it's probably a good time to wrap up the show here, but David Rand, thanks so much for coming on the show. Very interesting. I love your comments about China, especially.
You need to get him back to talk more just about China.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to do that. And Jim, great having you here as always.
Thank you. Pleasure to be asked.
Peter, and a pleasure as always. Great having you here. Really enjoy it. Want to thank everybody who's joined us for this show. We also want to give a shout out to Nate Anderson for helping us get the furniture here on the Autoline After Hours set. That's from Office Furniture Solutions. You can visit them at ofsonline.com or give Nate a call at 248-668-0077. And thanks, everybody, for having joined us tonight. Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.